Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, August 14th. Today, we're going to chat with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We're going to talk a lot about what happened in Virginia. There's a lot of stories, a lot of angles to that story, the issue of Confederate symbols, the police, were the police told to stand down. There's conflicting information about that. Domestic terror. I'm amazed how quickly Democrats bring up terrorism. It takes them a long time to do it when it's real terrorism, but anyway, this is also terror. I don't mean to downplay it, but it's just interesting how the Democrats react. The media coverage has been very interesting as well, and then the left versus right. I mean, there's extremes on both extremes here, but for some reason we don't hear that much about the extreme in the left or condemnations of the extreme in the left. North Korea is once again on the front pages, and so is Venezuela. President Trump making a statement about a military intervention in Venezuela, which, by the way, I don't believe that's even a priority as we speak. I don't see the advantage of an American operation in Venezuela. I don't see it at all. There are lots of better options. But anyway, he said it. Sometimes President Trump doesn't quite understand what he says. He said it this time, and he's created quite a problem for Vice President Pence, who's traveling in Latin America. And then if we have a chance, we'll talk about some of the political issues. A few days ago, President Trump and Senator McConnell got into it. And I happen to think President Trump is right about this one. I mean, look, Senator McConnell, it was the GOP who created the expectations about Obamacare. It wasn't anybody else but the GOP. So they're the ones who I think have to explain what's going on. So let's say hello. I'm sure you're not anywhere near President Trump tonight because there's quite a demonstration over by the Trump Tower. But let's say hello to our friend Bill Katz. How are you, Bill?
Just fine, Silvio. No, I avoided Trump Tower. I, of course, I would have loved to see the demonstration. But you don't have to actually have to see them anymore because you know exactly what's going to be on every sign. I mean, they take these signs out. I have a feeling that these left wing sign makers have kept whiteouts in business. Remember whiteout? We used to whiteout typing mistakes, and they every time they just take the old signs out. They white out whatever the country they're referring to or the issue, and they just put in a new issue because the language is exactly the same. I mean, it hasn't changed in 60 years. So
right.
You know,
They take their picture of Hitler, and they erase the face. It used to be Bush. It used to be Reagan.
Yes.
It used to be the first Bush. I guess it was Nixon at one time, and now it's Trump. I mean, I've never seen a picture of Obama as Hitler. I mean, never showed that one, Bill.
No, I remember these guys. I mean, some of them are now elderly. But I remember them from the Vietnam War. Hands off Vietnam, hands off Cuba, hands off this, hands off that, hands off your children, hands off women, hands off women's bodies. I mean, it's the whole dictionary of hands off.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, these protesters, they're as predictable as anything. But it does remind me of I have to laugh about this. Reminds me of that movie. Pride of the Yankees, you know, the Gary Cooper movie about Lou Gehrig. And there's one scene where, you know, his parents were German immigrants. They had never been to a ball game. So they go to Yankee Stadium one afternoon, and the mother is sitting around looking around, and she says, of course, this is when they used to play games in the afternoon. And the mother is looking around, and she says to her husband, "What are all these people doing here? Don't they have jobs?"
Right.
Yeah. And that's the same reaction I have to all these demonstrators. I mean, don't these people have jobs? I mean, don't they have something better to do at 8 o'clock New York time than to sit there for 2 hours with a stupid sign, Bill?
Well, I think that what it is you know, there's an author named Ron Radish, who is one of the few conservatives or people who became conservative who taught at the City College of New York. And he wrote a book called Red Star Over Hollywood about the Communist Party in Hollywood, which, of course, for years we weren't allowed to talk about because that's McCarthyism. No, it's not. They were there. And Ronald Reagan used to say he learned about communism by dealing with the Hollywood unions. And he made a point about the people who joined the party in Hollywood. And he said many of them joined because it gave them a home. And I think that's true of a lot of these movements on both the left and the right. People join not necessarily because they're believers, but because they find a home in these movements. And so they love to get on the subway and go downtown to the latest demonstration. You know, they may not know anything about the demonstration or even heard of the issues involved, but they love to be with these people. I mean, you know, these are... I think a lot of these demonstrations are made up of people who never had a prom date. You know?
Well, that could be. It could be their way of getting back at all those girls who didn't go out with them.
That's
so,
right,
you know,
exactly
they're gonna,
right.
They're going to create all these traffic jams so that the poor woman can get home from work on time. But it is fascinating. You're exactly right. All the signs are all the same. Everywhere
yes.
you see these demonstrations, the signs are all the same. Well, I mentioned that today in 1945, Victory, was it actually called VJ Day, Bill?
VJ
Day. The actual, yeah, VJ Day. And it was a day of celebration, of course, the end of at least a Japanese portion of the Second War. And there was a big big celebration. They didn't have any signs. You notice that? There was a
yes.
big celebration in Times Square in New York. And these two young people, I guess they kissed, and it became the most famous picture of that time period on Life magazine. I think the
yes.
photographer's name was Alfred.
Alfred Eisenstadt.
Yes.
Yes,
and
he
took
was
that
one
picture.
One of the most famous photographers of that era.
But you talk about good timing, Bill. I mean,
yes.
and just having a good eye for things. He must have been seeing a lot of people celebrating, and this—he just happened to capture this moment. Pretty incredible.
Yes, yes. And the nurse in the picture was finally identified. Oh, just must have been about. I think she's now gone. I think she's deceased.
Right. Yeah.
But she was identified. Many, many years later, there was really some difficulty in identifying who was in the picture. Some people came forward and claimed it, but I don't recall exactly how they identified her, but they were pretty sure at the end that one of the women who came forward was, in fact, her. And there were a lot of scenes, as you said, like that, but Eisenstadt had that that eye. He was a truly great photographer. He was a photographer who was the inspiration for many other Life photographers. VJ, I remember VJ Day, and just vaguely, I was a little kid, obviously, but I remember we lived in Brooklyn, and my father, I don't know if he was going off to work or coming back from work, but we heard, and families in those days had characteristic whistles. They would have a whistle that indicated it was somebody from that family who was whistling, so that people would know. I mean, it's something people don't do anymore, but he had a characteristic whistle, and he whistled up from street level, and my mother went to the window. In those days, you could open the windows, and he said, "The war is over." And that was the end of World War II. It was actually the day the Japanese surrendered. The formal end occurred on September 2nd aboard the battleship Missouri, but that was the day when they basically said, in somewhat convoluted language, that they accepted that this was the end of the war. And there were actually American planes in the air that day that were recalled when the announcement was made that Japan had accepted our terms, except for one which was negotiated, and that is that the emperor was permitted to remain as a symbol of the country. And, of course, you know, it was not only a great day, it was a great day of victory, it was a great day for national unity. The unity didn't last too long, but also it was the beginning of the rebuilding of America. because one of the things, the effects of the war, it's a terrible thing to say, but it's true that the war ended the Depression, the Great Depression. And Americans came back. They had at least a thriving economy. There was a recession after the war because so many war workers were thrown out of work. Many women who worked during World War II had to give back their jobs to the men whose places they took under law. But it was the beginning of new social movements, of the expansion of America westward. Much of that was due to the fact that soldiers going to the Pacific came through California, and they loved what they saw, and they decided to move there after the war. It was also the beginning of greater participation in the economy by people who never thought they would really work outside the home, especially women, and work during the war. And it was the beginning, really, of suburban America. That is one of the great effects of the Second World War, that right after the war, we passed legislation to help GIs, the GI Bill of Rights, GI mortgages, and some imaginative people took advantage of those, builders and industrialists. Cars became available again. People forget that you couldn't buy a car during World War II in the United States. All the plants were devoted to war work. So it was an incredible day.
Right. It was also, I was going to say, while you were listing all of those things, I was thinking it was also kind of the beginning of the baby boom. Baby boomers are from 1946 to 1964, as I understand. And I would guess that most of that was in the first 5 or 6 years, as you had these GIs come back. And, the ones who were fortunate to come back, obviously some didn't or came back with disabilities and so on. It reminds me of a movie, The Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, wonderful movie, William Wyler.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly, talking about three men and their experiences readjusting. But yes, I mean, I think that picture, I find it interesting because while I was reading about the picture, it looks like it became very popular. I don't know if it still is. For couples to go to New York and take a picture, in some cases even dressed up as a Marine, or not a Marine, but a Navy person, and a nurse, couples would dress up like that and take a picture in Times Square.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of cool. You know, I wish I had thought of that. That would have been a cool picture to have, you know, Bill.
That's right. And Times Square then, after that, that was really the period in which Times Square really was the heart of the theater district. And this was, and what was called the Crossroads of the World. There actually was a cafe right in Times Square called the Crossroads Cafe. You went to Lindy's and to Sardi's and different restaurants that became very famous. After that, Times Square began to deteriorate rather rapidly, and it's back now. It's back to its, it's not its original splendor, because I mean most of the big ads in Times Square are for television set companies or something.
Right.
But there was actually video coverage on VJ Day. There was actually live television coverage. Unfortunately, there were very few television sets to receive it, but they did get good practice. This was the beginning of the television era. During World War II, Americans got their news from newspapers, of course, from radio, and from newsreels. If you wanted to see anything visual moving, you had to go to a movie theater.
Right.
But the beginning, we got our first television set in 1948, and they were enormously expensive. And the screens were very small, 10-inch
right.
screens, 12-inch screens. People had television parties where they all gathered around to watch Milton Berle. And there was something very nice about that era. It was, an era of peace, which was unfortunately interrupted by the Korean War, but an era of very interesting politics. It was the beginning of the Civil Rights era. Post-war era was very exciting.
It sure was, and I was thinking the young couple kissing. There was a very popular song at that time with Harry James and Kitty Kaelin called It's Been a Long, Long Time, where
That's
she
right.
talks about Kiss Me One, Kiss Me
Kiss
Twice.
Me once.
And I don't know if the two things were related, the end of the war and the song.
Yes. Kitty Kaelin was one of my favorite singers. She died just a few years ago.
Mm.
And she was a singer whose career lasted a long, long time.
Yes.
Big band singer. I think the song you're referring to, It's Been a Long, Long Time, was actually sung by Betty Grable.
Could be.
Yes, who was Harry James's wife.
Okay,
and,
could be, yeah.
Yeah, but Kitty Callan sang, she sang in that era, I'm Beginning to See the Light. Good singer. That was the age of the big bands, which then began to also fade away because the costs of running them became too great. And,
right.
But for a time, we had that wonderful era.
And for about 10 years after that, Bill, there was that great run of New York baseball teams, you know, beginning with the Dodgers and the Yankees in 47 to the end of the 50s, where a New York team was in every World Series, I think, from 1947 to 1958, I believe. They were either the Giants or the Dodgers or, of course, the Yankees in the American League. And so that's something else that happened in New York during that time, too, Bill.
Absolutely. And you know, baseball was entirely different then. Today it's really just a business. It's we're very sad to see what's happened to many professional sports. But in those days, you really identified with the players. I was, of course, a Dodger fan. I didn't recognize the Giants as having any legitimacy at all. But they played in something called the Polo Grounds, which all we Dodger fans believed was a slum somewhere in the Bronx. What was great about it, to get tickets in those days, to show you how things have completely changed. Today you go to a computer, press a button, you've got your tickets. You had
right.
to go to the stadium. You had to
write in.
You could write in and buy your tickets by mail. But my mother would take me to Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, and you go into the Great Rotunda, and there was a ticket office there. And if there was no game that day at Ebbets Field, there was not much of a wait for tickets. You got your tickets, and if the guy was nice, he'd let you go out into the field and see where your seats were. So I remember being the only person in Ebbets Field one day. I just walked out to see where our seats were, and it was like a Hollywood imagination scene where you imagined the players who would be on the field the day you had your tickets. And you would go from Ebbets Field, which was the smallest stadium in the major leagues, and then if you wanted to go to a Yankee game, of course you went to Yankee Stadium, which was the largest. And the difference between the two was overwhelming. I remember my first day going to a game in Yankee Stadium, I saw Joe DiMaggio play, and he was like a little dot in center field. I mean, that's how big Yankee Stadium was. You went back to Ebbets Field, and there was in those days it was probably Dixie Walker, not Duke Snider, but you could see them. They had ears and eyes and everything like that. And Roger Kahn, the baseball writer, said one of the effects of Ebbets Field was you got to see what they were like.
The
ball players were right next to you. So
era. And then there was that lady in center field. We're going to take a break in a minute, but I wanted to get this in because you probably remember this. I read about it, that there was a lady in center field with a cowbell who would ring
believe. Yes, they had the Dodgers, what they called the Dodgers Symphony, basically an orchestra of people who couldn't play instruments. And they would come to every game.
Right.
And they would, and even the organist was famous, Gladys Gooding, who played the Star Spangled Banner.
Yes, it was really an amazing time, and all of that, of course, happened after the war that ended on this day in 1945. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about the terrible events in Virginia, a little bit of politics, North Korea as well. We'll be right back. Thank you. is Silvio Cantu in Dallas, Texas, and today we're chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, a very sad situation here in the country. The last 72 hours, I'm sure everybody who's followed the news knows what happens in Virginia. And obviously, one person dead, others officially or at least injured very badly. There may be more than one person dying from this terrible thing. So obviously that's what happened. And I thought maybe today we could talk a little bit about some of the angles of the story, beginning, of course, well, let's just say with the Confederate symbols, which seems to be the issue that created all of this, although I think white nationalists are and Nazis and so on are the last people in the world that I like to see associated with these symbols, because all they do is take advantage of the situation for their own benefit. But I keep coming back to this issue of Confederate symbols that I understand some people are angry about them, but on the other hand, there's a lot of people who see it as their heritage, and I'm having a very difficult time understanding how you can get these two groups to get along, because I know lots of friends of mine here in Dallas, Bill, who are very much, because of their heritage, because of their background, they have connections to the Old South, and even here in Texas, there's a lot of connections to the Old South. And I've always been of the opinion that you don't remove these symbols, but I guess in many cities run by Democrats, they're going to do it, Bill. So it's very troubling to me. I don't see a happy solution to this, Bill.
I don't see a happy solution either. I think that there are plenty of people in the South who are sincere and who say that, look, this has nothing to do with slavery. We're not in favor of slavery, but my great grandfather fought in the Civil War. They fought for their state, and I see no reason why these symbols should be torn down. On the other hand, African Americans with some degree of justification, a high degree of justification, would say, look, the Civil War was fought over slavery. We were the slaves, and when we see those symbols, that's what it means to us. And you're right, I don't see how they can get together. I think that, I hate to see statues of Lee taken down, because the strange thing is that leaving some of those statues up may lead to a greater understanding of what the Civil War was about. People see them, they ask questions, they want to know. If you blot the history out, you have nothing. That's why it was so important in Europe after World War II to preserve the concentration camps. And they are preserved. Not all of them, but most of them. And they are memorials. But people can go to these horrible places and see what actually happened. Now, in our Civil War situation, we do preserve the battlefields. We preserve Gettysburg. We preserve Antietam, where every American should visit if possible. And the statues, in a way, remind us of that era. And I think they lead to questioning. I think they lead to discussion. But I do understand the black perspective. I really do. I mean, I can see that, they pass a statue of Robert E. Lee, and we have to ask ourselves what our reaction would be if we passed a statue of Tojo of Japan, or
right,
of enemies of the United States, and maybe it would be the same reaction. So this is an argument without end.
Right, exactly right. For example, when I see a person with a T-shirt of Che, I get very upset.
Yeah.
But it would never occur to me that I should lock him up or tear the shirt off. In other words, he's got every right to wear it. But if he engages me in a conversation, I'll tell him, well, look, this is why I don't like this guy, and here's my reasons. But I think he's got every right to wear it in the United States. And my concern with these symbols is that once you get started, now you have other cities saying the same thing. You even have a city councilman in Baltimore saying that they should be burned down, which is pretty responsible, to say the least, or irresponsible.
Yes. Yes.
Where does it stop? There was a fellow on the radio this afternoon here in Dallas, who was saying that there are, I don't know how many statues or buildings or streets named after Robert Byrd in West Virginia. There's even an airport, I think, named after him.
Yes.
Well, he was a member of the KKK.
In his early years, he was, yes.
He was. Now, later he changed, and that's to his credit. Woodrow Wilson, President Wilson.
Oh.
Well, you could argue that he was not exactly the most black-friendly person in the world.
He wasn't. He was actually a racist, and by today's standards would never be president. He was a Southerner. The reason people don't know about Wilson is they associate him with New Jersey because he was governor of New Jersey, but actually he was a Virginian. And we have visited his home in Virginia, which is an interesting place to see, Staunton, Virginia. But he was a man who had very strong Southern roots. Many historians did, by the way. Toward the end of the 19th century, the profession of American historian was dominated by Southerners, which is one of the reasons why Ulysses S. Grant comes off so badly in so many of the histories. But yes, you know, again, what do you preserve and what don't you preserve? There are battlefields, as I said, that you can go to about the Civil War, but I think the statues may play a useful role. If you have a statue, for example, and a large plaque under the statue explaining it, and explaining it also from the black perspective, might actually be very useful.
I think so. Now, what some black friends of mine have told me over the years when I've spoken with them, even black conservatives, they've told me that what happened in the South after the Civil War was that many of these statues were sort of like in your face, North, and indirectly in your face, South, or blacks in the South. I'll give you an example. Here in Texas, in the Dallas area, there's a university called a high school called Robert E. Lee. And they're the rebels. They're called Robert E. Lee Rebels. That's their mascot. And before the game, for a long time before the game, a young man dressed up as a Confederate would ride a horse, and that was their battle hymn, you know, this young man running down the field as a Confederate soldier. Now, okay, I don't get offended by that, but I can certainly understand some people that do. Now, they don't do that anymore. They've changed that particular mascot. But for a long time, I think there were more high schools in Texas named after Robert E. Lee than Sam Houston. I mean, it's amazing.
Yes.
How many. And so I can understand that. But like you said, if there's not enough room in the country for a Robert E. Lee statue in, let's say, a park dedicated to the slaves or to the black victims, I think we can do both and coexist, Bill. Otherwise, this is going to be like Lebanon,
yes,
used to be in the 1980s, Bill.
That's very, very true. There is also, by the way, a Robert E. Lee Barracks at West Point, and the barracks was built in 1962, quite late, and named for Robert E. Lee. Of course, there's always been a Southern influence in the military, and I don't know what you do. I mean, do you rename it? Well, maybe you should. But then you go back in history, and who else do you remove? Yes, I wouldn't have a statue to Adolf Hitler. I really wouldn't, or to the Emperor of Japan. But there are people who are, you know, glorified in statues and in song and everything like that who weren't such nice guys. I mean, and do you remove the statue of George Patton from the library at West Point? Because we later found out that Patton was an out-and-out racist. I don't think so. You learn about him, and you learn about that negative side, but he did play an important role in victory. These are close calls. There are very few pure people. I mean, there are very few people who can withstand complete scrutiny by history. Now, for example, do we reject the Martin Luther King a memorial in Washington because he cheated on his wife, which he did? The answer is no. He was a great man. It's like the scales of justice outside the courthouse. There's some on one side, there's some on the other side, and we have to make thoughtful judgments. How about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, both of whom were slave owners? No question about that. You can go to Monticello, where I have visited, in Charlottesville, which we're now talking about. It's in Charlottesville.
Sure.
And you can take the slave tour, where they show you where the slave quarters were, and yet this is the man who was one of the founders of American freedom. It was the things that he did that contributed greatly to later the abolition of slavery. George Washington, I mean, you've got to mention it, you have to mention, but it was a different era. That doesn't mean we in any way justify it or say that it was, a semi-good thing. Slavery is all bad, but it was a different era. But you get into these things. I suspect this is the same discussion that people in other countries have regarding national symbols. The swastika, for example, was an Aztec symbol. Before Hitler appropriated it and made it into a Nazi symbol. When I went to the University of Chicago, the Social Sciences Building, every landing had a swastika inlaid into the tile. And nobody asked it to be removed because it was an Aztec symbol that was there before, in that building, before the Nazi era. But I certainly wouldn't choose it as a symbol today.
No, and I think that you're exactly right. There has to be like an explanation of Robert E. Lee. Maybe next to the statue, there can be a reference to the fact that he was, he was leading the army that was fighting the way they were fighting and all of that. But I just think that my issue with all of this is that I don't see how the country wins. And I will also say one thing. I think that the people who've taken this battle of the Confederate symbols are extremists, who are more interested in gaining politically.
Yes.
And I don't really think they're that concerned. And I'll say one last thing. Rasmussen had a poll in July, and Rasmussen is a pretty good pollster, but other polls have the same conclusion, and that is that most Americans don't see these symbols as racist. They see it as history. And I don't think the Democrats, who are trying to rebrand their party, I think the last thing they want to do going into a congressional election is to become the party that wants to bring down these statues. I think that's a loser for them, just like sanctuary cities is a loser. So there's somebody in the Democratic Party, maybe Joe Manchin, somebody like that, needs to stand up and simply say, look, enough is enough. Okay, enough is enough. Let's talk about the issues of the moment, Bill.
I think that's true, and I think you made a very good point about the people who exploit these disputes. I think that one of the problems I have with the current incarnation of the civil rights movement is that it's based too much on politics and political symbols and little political victories and not enough on the individual. You know, one of the things about some of these left-wing movements is that they're collectivist movements. They see people not as individuals but as parts of a group, and that's exactly the wrong way to do it in the United States. The African-American population will only gain if individual African-Americans gain and rise, and they bring up the group. And that's the way all groups make progress. It's not the group that actually makes the progress. It's individuals within the group, and they raise the group. This constant emphasis on political victories and elect a member of our group to this legislature or that legislature has resulted actually in very little for these people. They should really be studying how progress is made and spend most of their time doing that.
Absolutely. And no, you're exactly right. And it's all this focus on identity politics, I think, has also divided us further. You obviously have a better memory than I do of these things, but this is the most divided that I've seen the country by race in quite some time. I guess there could have been a time in the past when we were this divided. I have not seen it. I mean, right now it's about as ugly. It's very difficult for a black person and a white person to have a conversation because if you talk about black and black crime, they call you a racist. If you talk about lousy public schools in the inner cities, they call you a racist. So how can you have a conversation when all people do is question your motives, Bill?
Well, that's it. And one of the saddest things is that too many kids in minority groups are taught to believe that anybody who wants to improve their lot by things like higher educational standards, family programs, is a racist, insulting you, insulting your culture. And the reason is that whenever you start depending on politics, you're depending on leaders. And people should finally recognize the fact that most leaders do what's good for the leaders. You know, you see this all the time in politics. We talk, for example, about the Republican Party controlling all of Washington and not being able to get anything done. Well, you know, maybe occasionally they should have thought of the people they're representing and not just the leaders, and keeping leaders in power and keeping this individual influential. Politics is not, it was Harold Laswell of Yale who, and I can never remember the exact quote, he was asked to define politics, and he said politics is about who gets what, when, and how much. And I think that was the quote, approximately. And that's what politics is about. And too often what we see in politics is that only certain people gain, and it's mostly the leaders. There was a philosopher, actually a writer in the 1950s, called Eric Hoffer. Eric Hoffer was known as the longshoreman philosopher. He was actually a longshoreman who started to write, and his works were so good, they've become recognized. And he used to say that all causes become businesses, then they become rackets. John McCain likes to quote that all the time. And he's right. If you look at causes, you see them beginning to, they often start very idealistically, then the professionals take over, then the people who draw a salary take over, and after a time it becomes a business, and then later on it becomes a racket. And it is run basically for the benefit of the people who work there. And I just wish this was emphasized more by journalists who are always interviewing leaders of groups, but never interviewing the members of the groups. You know, you hear a lot of opinions by black leaders or Hispanic leaders or Jewish leaders or this leader, but very rarely do you actually hear the voice of ordinary people, and that's what we should be emphasizing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the media and the police. There's been some question about whether or not the police were told to stand down. The police chief is defending his actions, naturally. The governor was defending his actions. But I remember Saturday morning, or around noon Central Time, before the fellow drove the car, when it was being reported, it looked really chaotic on the television. It looked like a bunch of people were just engaging in fistfights. And I kept asking myself, why isn't there more police there? Why isn't there more... If you're gonna have anything having to do with these white nationalist groups, you know, you better have a lot of police protection there, because you know they're gonna get pretty wacko, and they're going to invite people from the other extreme who are pretty wacko too, and you have those two wacko people together, and you're gonna get some ugly things. Yeah. I don't know, but at least on the television, it didn't seem to me that there was enough security, Bill. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what it appeared to me like, Bill.
That's true, and the mayor of Charlottesville was on this morning, and he made an interesting observation. More and more will come out about this incident, which, by the way, wasn't that large. It really wasn't. It was a rally that was announced well in advance. It was not a mass rally, but he said that on Friday night, late Friday night, a federal judge handed down a decision. In response to a petition by, I think, one of the leaders of the march, the right-wing march, and that decision was that the city of Charlottesville had to give the marchers the venue that they wanted rather than the venue for the march that the city wanted. And the mayor was saying this morning that decision was catastrophic, because once that decision was made, they could not control the crowd. They had planned it all for a different venue, and they did not have the time to bring in new forces and additional assistance. That may very well be true. It may be that judicial decision was very instrumental in letting things get out of hand. At the same time, it is obvious that more police were needed. Now, there was this terrible, terrible incident of a car being driven into demonstrators, which is, of course, the kind of thing we expect in Europe, because that is a tactic used by ISIS. Now, the person driving the car, from what I understand, from what I've read, had a very complex background. He was a member of the extreme right. Apparently, at one time, he was an Obama supporter. At least that's what is being reported, and went to the other side. There are some questions being asked. I don't mean in any way to defend or explain this obnoxious individual, but that it may not have been intentional, that he may have been attacked while driving in the car before and may have panicked. Now, that may simply be an excuse given by some of the people in this movement, But I would wait again for the facts to come out. There will be a trial. He is going to be charged, and he will be on trial. There should also be a Virginia State Commission to look into this, to look at what mistakes were made, to look at what things were done right, let's find out the facts before we jump to a lot of conclusions, which of course everybody in Washington wants to do.
Right. I would ask a couple of questions of this commission. Number one, how was anybody allowed in a car to even drive in that area? Because
that's right.
A lot of times, if you notice in New York tonight, where President Trump is, it is impossible to get near there. I mean, they have these gigantic trucks protecting the location. I would have imagined that they would have done the same thing here, in part because you didn't want some crazy ISIS person to take advantage of the situation, you know, not necessarily one of them. So that's the first question I would ask. And the question I would ask of the governor is, why didn't you put the National Guard in larger numbers? Because the one thing that always works in these events is that if you have overwhelming presence of law enforcement, that at least most people get the message that the law enforcement is not going to fool around. Rudy Giuliani was great in New York at this.
He would always
have a lot of police officers, and at least you know that if you wanted trouble, you weren't going to enjoy it because you're going to have to fight the police bill.
That's exactly right. And it was obvious things were pretty lax in Charlottesville, and they were inexperienced. One of my daughters lived in Charlottesville for decades, so we know the city very well, and it's a very, very calm, kind university city. University of Virginia is right there. Well, part of the demonstration was at the University of Virginia. And it's not the kind of thing you associate with Charlottesville, and it may be that they just were not ready for this kind of intense demonstration. But the point you made was very good. How did the guy get to drive a car right through demonstrators? They shouldn't have allowed any cars in that area. So things clearly could have been done much better.
Well, and again, I don't like to second-guess police because they have a very difficult job to do, and let's wait for the facts. But this guy was driving his own car, which means that he was able to park nearby and drive. So that's another question. Now, what about the media coverage, Bill? I did find it interesting that the media immediately focused on these white nationalists and these people who did a very bad thing. I'm not defending them. But I've never seen them, for example, talk that way about Black Lives Matter. And there are a lot of things that Black Lives Matter has done or said that are as bad, if not worse, than what these people were saying. Again, I understand about the guy driving the car. That was horrible. But Black Lives Matter, I've seen that march they had here in Dallas. That's pretty intimidating, Bill.
Oh, yes, yes. They have these terrible slogans and chants. A cop of pigs in a blanket, fry 'em like bacon, referring to the police, and yet it's not reported in the same way. I have no brief or sympathy for the white nationalists or the neo Nazis. I have seen the real neo Nazis march past the White House. I did in the 1960s when I worked in Washington. I was in the area of the White House one day, and there were a whole group of brown shirts led by George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the leader of America's neo-Nazi movement at that time, march right past the White House. So I've seen this before, but the reality is you're absolutely right. There's a terrible, terrible double standard, and the double standard continues. The press just does not seem to understand that some of these presumably well-meaning groups that they endorse, like Black Lives Matter, actually have terrible agendas. And that understanding, thing also occurred during the Vietnam War, and I remember it. I saw it with my own eyes. You could go to demonstrations that were supposedly anti-war demonstrations, and they were really pro-communist demonstrations, but you would never know it from the way they were reported. We really have a problem at this time in this country with our press. We really do. The fundamentals of journalism are being forgotten, you know, to report the news without fear or favor, in favor of making a difference. We're here to make a difference. We don't want to just report the news. And there is, if one must say it, a certain level of dishonesty about it. And I think the American journalism is in very serious trouble.
And people are catching up with it, Bill. I really believe that. I think the way this event was covered was seen by a lot of people as very one-sided. Again, no one's defending what this young man did. And I like to see these white nationalists locked up. They're horrible. What they stand for is horrible. But they still represent an extremely small number of people in the country. Roger Simon had a great article about this.
Yes, he did.
Just a very small group of people. There are a lot more members of Black Lives Matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter has actually been on the streets a lot more than these people have been on the street. In fact, if this incident with the car had not happened, we wouldn't even be talking about this. Because the truth is that that event on Saturday was kind of falling apart after a while, and it was unfortunately this automobile that sort of took it to the front page. But I think the country catches on with it. I really do. I think a lot of the people in the country are seeing this one-sided approach, Bill. I really do.
I agree. And one of the things that has occurred in this country in the last 40 years is that media has become a subject of conversation. The media is not supposed to be the story, but very often the media is the story. And the effect of that is that people in the country become more and more knowledgeable about the media. If you mention press bias today, it's a subject that people talk about with their families or with their friends, and they, in effect, become experts at it, and they become experts at detecting it. And after all, the media is out there with the public, so people can see what they are doing. And what they are doing is in the minds of many Americans, I think millions of Americans, is to distort the news, and the news should not be distorted.
Absolutely. And I think what the reporting coming out of this weekend, I thought was extremely one-sided overall. And there should have been a little bit more balance about what happened without taking anything away from the fact that it was a bunch of white nationalists who were doing this. But the point is, on Saturday morning, they were fighting people from the other side. And I didn't hear that much about the other people. They were also creating a lot of trouble themselves. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with Bill. We're going to talk about North Korea and Iran. Both of those countries have been in the news this week. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. One more segment here with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, North Korea back in the news. Apparently in the last hour or so, Secretary of Defense Mattis has made some pretty strong remarks about North Korea. I hope nothing happens, but it does get – I do worry more and more that something will happen, Bill.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Mattis because, yes, he did mention it in reference to some anticipated launches by North Korea. We apparently have detected from our surveillance activity at launch sites that is typical of activity that precedes a launch. Now, the North Koreans have threatened to fire missiles at about this time, they said mid-August, at Guam, Guam being an American possession in the Western Pacific. And that would be an absolutely catastrophic and suicidal event for the North Koreans, but they may just do it. And I think that Mattis is essentially warning about that. It's obvious, though, also that Trump is getting some results from his campaign against North Korea. China has said China is North Korea's main ally in Asia, but that it will impose the sanctions ordered by the United Nations and impose them immediately. Now, I think China is sending a message both to North Korea and to the United States. The message to North Korea is, look, we may be your friend, but you have to abide by certain international rules. And if you don't, you're not going to have our support. I think the message to the United States is, we're giving you something you want in going along with the sanctions against North Korea. Now, what do you have for us? And I think that's an important question.
Sure, and also, it's interesting, President Trump seems to elevate the criticisms of China whenever this comes up, and it's like you get the feeling that he's negotiating with the president of China and saying, look, you do this, and I'm going to do a lot of things for you. And so you get the feeling that there's something going on behind closed doors, and hopefully it's enough to prevent the war, because I don't know of anybody who wants that war. But there may be something else even more important, Bill, and that's Iran. They're in the background making a little bit of noise too, Bill.
Yes, well, they don't want to be left out of the party. And Iran is very much linked with North Korea, remember. We have asserted that North Korean technology is transferred to Iran. And that is very much a part of the story. One of the things that outrages me in the North Korean issue is the indifference of our so-called European allies, especially Angela Merkel, who seems to be lecturing us more than the North Koreans. You know, the Europeans are interested only when they think Europe is involved. They don't seem to realize Europe is involved in this because Iran is a direct threat to Europe. Now, they believe, apparently, in Europe that that's not true because we're now trading with Iran and, you know, the business will prevail. Well, you know, they said that Hitler was no threat either and that he really didn't mean a lot of these things. So I'm certainly not sanguine about Iran. But, yes, Iran is making noise, and we are being challenged, and we are being challenged very vigorously. Now, one thing that we have to be very careful about in our confrontation with North Korea, this was brought out in an Associated Press piece last week, which was actually very well done, and that is that if, in fact, we elect to shoot down a North Korean missile, the equipment better work. You know? I mean, the nightmare scenario is that we choose, after a launch, to take it one step further and shoot down the North Korean rocket, and we fail. That would be an enormous humiliation for the United States, enormous.
So, yeah, it kind of reminds me of, remember during the Gulf War when we were shooting down the Scuds, and they all did work in that time. And that was a great moral victory, not just for the United States, but for Israel, because they were counting on the United States to defend them. So you're right. We hope that they work. But we also hope that if we shoot one of these down, that we're ready for something happening from North Korea over the border. I mean, there's no pretty story to this, Bill. That's the amazing part about it. There's simply no, this is a movie with no, you know, this is like a director who's putting together the ending, the end of the story, and there's no happy ending. There's no moment, happy ever after moment. It's just, which one of these horrible endings do I choose? That's kind of the way this movie is, Bill.
Yes, it is. There are no good options in North Korea. There's not one good option that we can, impose individually. There is a good outcome if the North Koreans stood down, ended their missile program, ended their nuclear program, and made nice with South Korea. That would be a good outcome, but nobody really expects that outcome. We really don't know where we're heading. And remember, you made a point about the Gulf War and the shooting down of the Scud missiles that were being launched at Israel. Which actually wasn't a participant in the war, but they got it anyway. But that could happen again. You know, we could have an action in Korea, and the reaction could come from could come in the Middle East. You know, the Iranians might say our North Korean friends need help. Why don't you, and talk to Hezbollah and say, why don't you fire about 500 missiles into Israel and deflect the American attention? We really are going into an unknown period, and we are doing so with a president who does not inspire the greatest confidence on the part of the American people. But I think so far he's actually handled it very, very well.
Well, he's got a great team around him. That's the one thing that that I'm happiest about. I mean, he's got a great team around him, and I think if we ever have to get into a situation like that, I trust Secretary Mattis and even Vice President Pence, who I think keeps looking better and better all the time as a very sensible man. Well, could it get any crazier next week, Bill? Any thoughts about next week? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward. First of all, we look at the railroad stations, at the airports, to see when the psychiatrists return to work, and maybe things will get, once the prescriptions start again, maybe things will get milder. I don't know, but what we're looking for, obviously, is the aftermath of Charlottesville, and the left will try to make it as unpleasant as possible, drag the story out. I think it will disappear within a few days. But then we have Korea back, and we have the possibility of a real confrontation. You know, if these missiles are going to be launched in the next couple of days or weeks, that could be a very dramatic moment in current history. We also have the beginnings, and remember, September is right around the corner, of the 2018 congressional campaigns. They will start early. It is going to be vicious, absolutely vicious, and I think we may be in for a lot of surprises. I think that Trump we may have talked about this last week, that Trump is going to have to confront the congressional Republican leadership and say, look, fellas, you're going into a campaign to maintain your power. You've got to give me something to support you with. And, you know, what if Congress strikes out and doesn't do anything? Will Trump actually get up there and endorse their reelection? I'm not so sure he will. So it's going to be an exciting political period.
It's going to be very exciting. Every week seems to be exciting, and all I can say is mark it down for the next time. I'm sure we'll have something exciting to talk about, Bill.
Oh, no
question.
And
now I want you to run over to the Trump Tower and take a sign that says, "Everybody go home."
That's right. That's right, I think I have some old communist signs in my closet that I picked up at demonstrations in the 60s. I'll white out, you know, hands off Vietnam, and I'll write in hands off Trump. That'll make me very popular in New York.
Yes, that'll make you so popular that everybody will want to interview you.
You'll be on
CNN, MSNBC. You'll be all over the television tonight. So we're looking forward to that, Bill. We hope to see you tonight on MSNBC.
I'll wait.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you as always. It's always a lot of fun to have you on the show. Thank you for your time, and we'll do it again.
Absolutely, this Sunday.
Thank you so much. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Always a lot of fun to talk to Bill. Thank you for listening, folks. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.